Come on, people. It's time to live it up.
This is Rosemary Rodriguez, your host of The Director's Chair. This is the place to talk about directing, producing, writing, acting, and any other trash Hollywood talk that comes up, and that might happen tonight.
Never with me.
Yes, with our special guest. So there's no restrictions here, no politics, just honest talk about what it's really like being a part of the film and television industry. Our focus will always be about collaboration, when it works and when it doesn't. And every show will have different guests. And I'm going to do some. Last week was the first podcast, and I didn't say anything about myself. So I just want to introduce myself just so people know before I introduce my special guest. So I'm just going to tell you I'm a filmmaker who also was fortunate enough to direct television. I've directed two features, Acts of Worship and the upcoming Silver Skies. And I get to direct TV shows like Jessica Jones, Empire, The Good Wife, and just a lot of shows. Outsiders, Rescue Me, all this stuff. Okay, enough about me. It's always, you know, just better to talk in context. So my very special guest tonight is someone who wrote this book, this amazing book that spoke to my heart. It's Josh Sabara. Josh is a renowned publicist whose company, Breaking News PR, reps among other people, Nancy Grace. His past experience includes publicity and marketing for A&E, Lifetime, New Line Cinema, and Miramax, where he spearheaded campaigns for The Notebook, Harry Potter, The Station Agent, Wedding Crashers, and a whole lot more. And if that isn't enough, he wrote this book. So a big, big shout out, first of all. Hi, Josh.
Hi, Rosemary.
I have to give a big shout out to your amazing social media fans, your Twitter fans.
I know, you have the best people.
I
know. And they better be calling in.
Well, I just they're so cool. And if anything's stopping them from calling in, that was my first question. What would that be?
What
would be stopping them from calling you? Because this really spoke to my heart.
You know, there are a lot of, you know, I also write for Gay Times magazine in London and do a lot of dating pieces for The Advocate and other outlets. And the nature of what I write is sometimes very personal. And so I think sometimes people prefer to keep that, you know, to a private email or to a private Facebook message. They're not necessarily putting it out there in the open for everyone.
Got it. Well, they could know that they can use a false name. They can be anonymous.
Exactly.
They're not Skyping.
No.
They're free to call.
That's right.
And they're calling 800-893-9562.
Hold on, I have to write that, put that in.
Oh, yeah, put that in. Tweet that out to your wonderful people. I think they were really cool.
Let's repeat that number, 1-800-893-9562.
I mean, what I've come to realize, and you kind of turned me on to this a little bit, the social media stuff, and sort of schooled me on it early on, because you've been in it for a while.
I schooled you with a K, S-K-O-O-L-E-D, schooled.
You old schooled me.
You got schooled.
Because, you know, what I've come to realize only recently is that it's kind of like, okay, I had an interview today about my movie that's going to be playing at Stona Film Festival. And
Silver Skies.
But one of the questions they asked me was, you know, what was the experience like going to festivals? And it made me realize that when I go to festivals, it gets rid of all the gatekeepers. It's just me and the audience.
Right.
And that's what it feels like social media. It's like we get to be out there and connecting with people that like our work with all of the bullshit in between.
Well, I think there are pluses and minuses to that. I think that, yes, it does make everybody particularly accessible.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas before you wouldn't necessarily be able to be in touch with somebody in that kind of casual environment.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, it also sort of gives a high rise to people who want to be mean or be bullies or, you know, so I think it's a double-edged sword. I think, you know, you can use your social media powers for good and you can use them for evil.
Have you experienced any of that?
Oh, of course. You know,
really?
When you put yourself out there publicly, there will always be somebody who disagrees or who doesn't, you know, they always, you know, what it was Taylor Swift who said, haters gonna hate, hate, hate. You know, it's gonna happen. I just say haters are fans in denial.
No, I like that. I like that a lot. Because, you know, one of the shows that I did that kind of got me jump-started was Jessica Jones.
Right.
And so, you know, in the beginning, I was following what Jessica Jones was tweeting. And then all of a sudden, I really got into it because I realized they were so smart. And if somebody said something nasty, they would retweet it and say something snarky. Not cutting and not deep, but just like with a sense of humor to it. And so sort of tweet it out again and retweet it. And I was like, that's kind of cool. Like,
well,
that's smart.
I mean, to be honest, things like that sort of take the wind out of somebody's sails, you know, and it's sort of, you can see that somebody's playing along or that they have a sense of humor about it, which is nice.
I like that.
But I think sometimes social media, you know, as great as I think it is, and I embrace all of it, but at the same time, you know, I think we all forget that the people on the other end of these accounts are humans.
Right.
And, you know, I like people to not lose sight of that. When you go on Facebook and you leave a message, I mean, I had somebody leave me a message the other day saying, oh, you're one of the ugliest men I've ever seen. Well, you know, I'm sorry you feel that way. No need to keep looking at the picture then. Scroll
on.
That's
insane.
But who takes the time to do that?
I don't know.
You know,
right.
And that's what I'm saying. It's like,
that's ridiculous.
You know, so I mean, it hurts. You know, if you're human, it hurts. You know, anything like that is
painful. Well, and that's part of what you know, Porn Again, you really did a great job. I know, you know, I don't know how much you want to focus on this or not, but
As much or as little as you would like.
Well, I just love this book. And thinking about, like, hanging out with you tonight, mm-hmm. I just thought there's something that I'm always drawn to, and it's people that are very honest mm-hmm. about their feelings of loneliness mm-hmm. and rejection, because I think we all experience that.
I think that's a universal thing in some way.
But it's so great that you put it out there, and works of art that speak to that human condition really speak to me, mm-hmm. like get inside my heart.
Same. I mean, those are the kinds of books and stories I like to read. I mean, my bookshelves are full of memoirs and people's stories more than you'll find fiction even.
So do you think that sense of loneliness, like how does the social media connecting with fans help with that?
You know, you can have 100,000 people around you and feel lonely. I don't mm-hmm. think loneliness is about volume or numbers. I think it's about the quality of the people around you and how nourished we feel by the people around us. So I never subscribe to the idea that a lot of people or a lot of followers, a lot of it make us feel not lonely.
Sure.
Sadly.
But
you know,
I mean
some
think
of the people who have, you know, people who have these, and also another thing to think about, which is something you've brought up to me before, is the lives that you see people leading on social media mm-hmm. are not necessarily indicative of what their lives really are. And I think we all have a tendency to look in from the outside and feel like we're less than or we're not as worthy because we're not at this event or we're not out with this person or we're not whatever. And it's sort of, you know, it's not necessarily real life. It's the image that we present to people.
That's true. That is true. And I've been thinking about that a lot lately because, you know, because I like to talk about collaborating here and think about collaborating. And one of the things is, you know, I'm always a little torn. It's like, okay, I'm posting pictures of people with me because I'm sorry, I'm a fan of the people that I work with.
Of course, and you're entitled to be.
And I'm really, when I'm on set, I'm really love what I do. Doesn't matter what, like I will find a way. I love actors. Like they just get me excited. I just really love them. So
you don't find them draining at all?
I occasionally they're draining, but I don't see them as draining. I see them as
try having them
they
around
just need a little more attention.
24/7. Get those calls at 2 a.m. when they're crying about something.
No, I understand
or
that.
Or go to bed with a couple of them, then call me, Rosemary.
Well, no, I understand. But what I'm saying is that There's something, you know, it presents a front of like, oh, this is so glamorous and stuff. But really, there's also an element of trying to share your enthusiasm for some, or at least that's how I feel like, for something I do.
Well, I think there's a fine line. It's about being organic. It's about being authentic about
You're right.
it. And I think when you are authentic about it and you are approaching it from the idea of somebody who loves actors or is a fan of somebody's work, I think that comes through. And I think people who do it in a very contrived way, I think that comes through as well. So really it's about the viewer and the follower. It's up to them to sort of discern what they're seeing.
Right, right. Well, I mean, I recently, you know, as I was telling you before we started here today, you know, just gone through like a little dark window of not feeling so good. And you know, which for me lasts for like a week and a half. Because that's not me. I just keep taking action. I just like the Energizer Bunny. Like, right. I just keep going and going. I just don't stop.
You're busier than anybody I know.
So I'm like, all right, I'm just going to keep going and going. But sometimes I have to stop. And I just get really sad. And I feel the disappointment of things, you know, because I always have my eyes on the prize and, you know, that Academy Award or whatever that is.
Right.
Whatever that sounds like to anybody, I don't care. It's just stuff that's in my heart. So, you know, I think that just threw me off, the Academy Award thing. All right.
Why were you going over your speech in your head right now?
No, I think I was just like embarrassed that I actually said that out loud, because I'm like, that's in my heart and my husband knows, but I don't really think I put that out there. Like,
we'll just say you're
way.
Not going this year because Jada Pinkett has called for a boycott.
Well,
so that's why you've decided to not go this year.
Well, I've never gone, but
we're going to use Jada Pinkett and Will Smith as an excuse. I'm not going because Spike Lee doesn't think I should.
I love them, by the way.
Who,
I love
Jada and
Will Smith and Jada Pinkett Smith.
Well, the only
people.
Thing I don't understand about it, and obviously I do think there is some things that need to be changed with how the Academy works, but Jada Pinkett says she's boycotting. I'm like, were you even invited?
Well,
because
I think,
to boycott something, I think you got to get an invitation.
I think, yeah, but you know what? I think it's kind of cool because, you know, I think that she's really looking out for her husband.
Right, but is it conceivable?
Who did a great movie.
Yes, but is it conceivable that that wasn't one of the five best performances this year? Because I've seen all of those movies and I did not think that was.
I don't know.
I'm not a movie critic.
I don't know.
I'm just saying it wasn't one of my favorite performances.
I just saw it like that. I saw it as a wife being protective of her husband as well. Not to diminish what she's doing. I just think that's, you know, taking a stand on something. And
I think you are such a lovely person with such a positive outlook. And it's one of the things that I appreciate most about you.
Oh, but that's where I was going. No. So I go to a dark place and then you post these things and then. Somehow what happened to me is like through Facebook and Twitter and Instagram and all this stuff, somehow I got in touch with some amount of gratitude because I'm like, it's not bullshit. Like, I actually get to do this stuff.
Right. You're living your dream.
And it's not the dream that I imagined because it's not over yet. But right. It somehow did something positive for me it's easy to, this stuff is just draining. It just takes my attention away from what I want to do. But you know what? It's fun to connect with people. And it really did bring me some gratitude and help me get out of a hole, as well as this podcast did. It's kind of empowering. Whatever we can do to empower ourselves.
Well, and now you have me here and I'm really just a ray of sunshine.
You totally are. I mean, you are.
It's been said many times.
Well, I mean, you
that
know,
I am just joy in human form.
I think, look, I met you in New Orleans.
Right.
Right?
Yep.
I was directing a Lifetime movie down there called The Pregnancy Pact.
Uh-huh.
And you were publicity person.
Yeah, I was working for the network at the time.
Exactly.
And I just happened to be down there on the set and we
totally connected. Totally connected. Because I love your sense of humor.
You know, I was not a New Orleans fan either.
No, I felt like I was stuck on a cruise ship for seven weeks.
Before I decided to eat everything in sight, I was watching what I ate. And everything, I couldn't find one place to eat there.
Except that oyster place.
The oyster place literally had dirt on the plate.
So I'm curious, like, since we're
talking... By the way, can I eat some of these raisinets?
Yeah, please.
This is a show about entertainment and movies, and so raisinets.
So I brought raisinets,
Movie candy.
Yes.
And
yes.
I don't turn down candy.
That's my favorite movie candy.
Mine too.
And it's also not noisy if you're going to eat it right now.
Well, and have you ever put raisinets goobers in popcorn?
In popcorn. Because of you, I do that.
I mean.
Yes, it's really good. So this thread of loneliness and abandonment and all this, mm-hmm. that was my connection to your book.
Right.
So I felt so much for this gifted, smutty, funny, smart little kid who was like in this book, who was getting picked on, who I could totally relate to. Not that I was picked on, but just the amount of fear and the inability to express what you have inside to express.
Well, because when you're 5, 6, 7 years old, it's really hard to articulate. You know, you don't really understand what these feelings are that are going on. And how do you explain that to an adult? I mean, nowadays we have clinical labels for everything. I mean, if you pass gas at the wrong time, they have a name for it. You know, at that time, nobody would have said, oh, he's OCD or he has the anxiety problem. I mean, I was having full-blown panic attacks at 6 years old.
Right.
You know, and I think, you know, it's just the time. And I think my parents dealt with it the best way they knew how, which was they accommodated as much of the quirkiness as they could. Mm-hmm. You know, I had an aversion to getting wet. If I was wearing any sort of dry clothing, if there was one drop of water, my clothes had to be changed from head to toe. Underwear, socks, doesn't matter that the drop was on my sleeve.
Right.
Everything had to be changed. So my mother would send changes of clothes in Ziploc bags to everything I went to. So they didn't make me feel bad about having those feelings, but they just accommodated them and we moved on, you know.
So they didn't make you feel bad.
They didn't.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
So your parents are the other part of the book that I love. Mm-hmm. I mean, I just love, they're like my fantasy parents.
Yes. They're pretty amazing people.
Not to give anything away, but you know, there's a bit in the end of the book.
Does everybody love that I'm having a meal? Like I'm literally sitting here, I'm like, Rosemary.
Keep going. I want to make you happy. I want you to be happy. But you know, you were just talking to me about, you know, you go all over the place with your book, mm-hmm. and that you were in a factory where they make sex toys.
That's not in the book.
No.
No.
But as you mentioned that, all right. I could do was picture your parents, a picture of your parents and you bringing them to like a sex toy shop.
Yeah.
And like holding a dildo with a picture of them.
Totally did.
And like, I just love them.
Father's a urologist, so... You know, things that to some people would be considered, you know, forbidden or taboo conversation with their parents. I mean, that's just business for my father. You know, taking my dad to the sex store in L.A. means he can write off the trip. That's how I look at it. I said, look, now you've been doing some research.
Did that make it easier for you to try to talk about sex or your sexuality with him?
You know, what's funny. I went before I came out, and I was 31 when I came out, and I was a virgin until I was 31, which is something I talk about in the book. And it was not something, I was very uncomfortable talking about anything that related to sexuality before I came out because I didn't want people thinking of me in those terms or asking me questions or bringing things up that I wasn't comfortable discussing. I think I was so closeted and so repressed that when I finally came out, I didn't really step out of the closet. I kind of zoomed out of the closet. And I went from, on a scale of 1 to 10, with 1 being not talking about it, I would say I'm a 10. Like now I'll talk about, you know,
anything.
My mother might call and I'll be like, I have somebody in bed with me. Can I call you back? You know, I mean, I'm that open
about it. It's okay.
And also, you know, talking about a lot of the, you know, and I write a sex column. For Gay Times in London, and which is available here as well for anyone who's interested. But so, you know, a lot of that stuff, you know, my parents read and support everything I do. So mm-hmm. they see that I'm talking about, you know, the best way to give a blowjob.
How was the journey for them? Like, so you went from very shut down to like, boom, I'm out there. How did they handle that?
They've been so supportive and proud of the book and just the way they've been my whole life. So
that's so sweet.
I know.
I love them.
It's really a gift, you know, and I believe me, I know that it is. I do not take for granted. I know what other people have gone through mm-hmm. In their coming out stories and, you know, people who have been thrown out of their homes or people who, I mean, if you go and look at the Gay and Lesbian Center here in, you know, in our own town in L.A., and there are beds for kids whose parents threw them out because, you know, and they have nowhere to go tomorrow. Mm-hmm. You know, and I know what a gift it is to have parents who are understanding and enlightened and smart and accepting. And I don't for a minute, you know, I'm grateful all the time.
And how much does thinking about like that, like because I would think that this book would have a lot of influence on people that are trying to find their own voice and trying to find some level of self-acceptance for who they are.
I hope so. You know, the title, as you know, Porn Again, is a provocative title. And the idea of porn, the role that porn plays in my life is sort of interesting as it threads through the book. And it's not what people think. Mm-hmm. And if anybody understands my sense of humor, and I tried to convey that, you know, that was part of the idea of the cover, was me holding this, you know, me holding a rooster.
A rooster.
Some people say to me, why do you have a chicken?
Hello.
So, you know, the idea of that was so people see that the title is tongue-in-cheek and that there's more heft and more grit to this story than one would think.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm hopeful that people find it for whatever reason, whether they think that's funny or sexy or provocative, but for whatever reason people find it and come into the tent, as long as they stay and feel satisfied once they're in, I'm good with however it is you find it.
Yeah, I mean, it's so much about your sense of humor. Just as soon as you look at it, it's so much about your sense of humor. And that's how it feels like you got through all of your life, was with your sense of humor.
Well, I think that's a lot of people who are sort of bullied, or, you know, you sort of grow, you know, it manifests itself in different ways.
Mm-hmm.
For me, being like having like a sharp cutting wit and being able to cut somebody down in 2 seconds was my defense against that.
Right. And so you feel empowered finishing the book and getting out in the world?
Absolutely.
You totally do, right?
Yeah. I mean, it's out there, and it, you know, the thing that's interesting is once you write a book, you know, you pour everything you can into it, and then it's out in the world and it's not yours anymore. It's like it then becomes what other people want it to be, or whatever it is he or she takes from their experience in reading it. So, you know, I wrote it with the best intentions and with, you know, the voice that I felt I wanted people to hear, and then it becomes theirs, you know? So I'm always thrilled when I get letters or emails or texts from people.
Or phone calls when you're on a podcast.
Or phone calls, people. Let's remind them of the number 1-800-893-9562. But you get people who have been touched by something that you've done, and I'm sure you've had that too. You know, people who see the work that you've done for whatever reason, it strikes a chord with them, or it helps them, or it, you know, gives them some pleasure in a dark time. Whatever it is, it's really fulfilling to get those messages.
It is. Well, I know. I mean, that goes back to that, you know, that the social media, all that stuff, and connecting with people who like your work, which is something that, you know, there's always a bit of insecurity when you put yourself out there, for me, for any artist. And then, you know, when you get feedback from people, lots of times I do jobs and I work with people in television, they're very busy. Everyone's overworked. They've got a lot going on. You know, we prep an episode and then we start shooting it. Once we start shooting it, that train has left the station. So they're on to prepping the next episode.
Right.
So then by the time I cut it and I turn it in, they're already like 2 episodes later. They've forgotten like who I am. Like, it doesn't even matter. So you don't really know, very rarely, and I would say definitely not enough, do people even say thank you or good job. You just don't get those emails and phone calls very often at all.
But also, I think people connect to different mediums in different ways.
But I mean, what's nice is that when I'm talking about collaborate, like with people that I work with.
Right.
So what's nice for me is when these episodes air, and sometimes people will notice things. There'll be a fan or this one who'll notice the shot or might even take a picture of it. And it's like,
well, I think I did that to you.
That's amazing when that happened. That just genuinely fills me up.
Didn't I just do that recently? Like, I saw there was a shot on The Good Wife.
Yeah.
And it was an episode that you directed, and it was through the peephole.
Oh, yeah, you did, yes.
And I happened to see that, and I was like, is that your genius?
Yeah. No, that was a shot that was designed. I mean, it's not, some special
and
effects.
As a consumer, I'm not a filmmaker.
Mm-hmm.
So as a consumer who's a fan of television, for me to see something and notice a shot.
Right.
You know, is...
It's great.
That's extraordinary.
But I mean, that feels really good that people notice your work, because sometimes we don't always remember. I mean, I'm very big on saying thank you to people that I work with. Because everybody's busting their ass. And at the end of the day, that's the least I can do.
Gratitude is the attitude.
But it's true.
I always say that. Not really. But I but I'm so going to start.
Starting now, this is like the best thing that could come out of this podcast is that you start saying thank you more.
All the time.
Well, you're a grateful person. It's not even it's not even a joke.
Person.
You are.
But I do joke around a lot. I think sometimes I could be a little clearer with people that you know, I think it never hurts to tell somebody directly what you're thinking or feeling.
I totally agree. And, you know, maybe that's more East Coast thing. I don't know.
Yeah, I don't think people do it enough in general.
I don't think we
tell people that, you know, and things are so, everything in life changes and happens so quickly. Mm-hmm. And I think it's really important to let people know what we're thinking.
I try to reach out even in emails and let people know, let the actors know, let the crew know, let the DP, or, you know.
Because, you know, actors need...
Who doesn't need
more stroking?
They need a lot of love. And right. I'm here to give it. So now that you're all empowered.
Yes.
And your family life is great. Your parents are awesome.
Yes.
So what's your next step? What are you writing now?
I'm writing a novel.
Okay.
And it is a dishy, fun, I like to call it a thinking person's beach read. And it's sort of Dominic Dunn meets Jacqueline Suzanne meets Jackie Collins.
Oh, okay. So is this, okay. So it'll be fun.
Yes.
It'll have humor.
Yes. And it'll be, you know, it has that Devil Wears Prada, you know, Romana Clay kind of feel.
That was about the fashion industry.
Mm-hmm.
So what is this one about?
This has some Hollywood in it. Yeah.
Little Hollywood insider stuff.
Mm-hmm. It's going to be quite the education for people.
Oh, that's good. That's going to be fun.
Anyone who was concerned about the first book should clear the decks for this one.
So
Josh is on the loose.
That's one of the things that you did. You became very successful when you were younger.
Mm-hmm.
And you started working in Hollywood and hanging out with people like Cher and Dolly Parton and escorting them. Like, you got into publicity, like, right away.
But I wouldn't say, I mean, yes, I worked on projects with them.
You were working with them. You were around them.
Yes.
Today, you would have been social media with them, doing the thing. So hanging is all.
But you know what's funny? When I was little, not that I'm gay or anything. when I was little, I remember my mother doing the laundry in the laundry room, and I remember standing at the side door. I might have been 7, 8, and I would say, do you ever think I'll meet Dolly Parton? Do you think I'll ever meet Cher? Like, I would say, I mean, I was like a little kid, and my mom, don't ask me, like, why she would just, you know, answer. She would say, I'm sure you will, honey. Like, and that was it. You know, and then, of course, you know, I think by the time I was 19 or 20, I'd met every gay icon just about. I haven't met Barbara.
Oh, Barbara would be a good one, wouldn't she? She'd be a good one.
I may have to take a trip out to Malibu and just knock on the door.
Maybe she's listening.
Barbara, can you hear me? am I allowed to sing?
Yeah, you can. We don't have to pay for
anybody who owns the rights to the Yentl Squad, don't come after us.
She's pretty great. But I love that you had a vision for yourself, and then there you are with them years later. So where do you see yourself? What's your next vision? Where do you see yourself in 5 years from now?
You know, I'd like to have the second book come out and be, you know, done writing the third. I really have found that I have the real comfort level writing. And I hopefully, you know, people will embrace the next book as much as they embrace this one.
Mm-hmm.
And that I will be able to have a career doing that because I really enjoy it. And I think I'm best able to express myself that way. And I think I can get my humor across. I think I can get my message across that way. You know, I can't sing. I can't dance. I mean, I have no talent otherwise, basically.
You sounded pretty good just there a minute ago. It's kind of cute.
I have practiced Yentl a few times.
In the mirror?
Maybe Funny Girl, too. I pretend like I'm on a tugboat and I sing Don't Rain on My Parade.
Oh, my God. I have it in my car. We can sing it on
good.
The show. I really do have it in my car.
So do I.
Okay. So wait, something you just said.
Don't tell me.
Oh, why do you think writing is so, I guess it sounds like it's therapeutic, but it's successful
for
you.
It's therapeutic, but also I think there is a power in being able to, and when I say power, I mean in a good way. I think there's a power and control, and I tend to be somebody who needs to be in control. But there's a power and control to how you tell your story and how you deliver your story, almost more so than there is with a lot of other mediums. You know, you know, when you're, as you know, when you're directing something, doesn't necessarily mean you've written it. So the writer has an input, or the producers have input, or they want you to do something this way or that way. Now, yes, with a book, an editor can come in and suggest or ask, or the, you know, a publishing company wants you to do something differently. But for the most part, things that translate well to the page are the authentic, organic things that you do.
Right.
So for me, I feel like it's an outlet, and it's just, I feel that it's just, I don't know, it makes me feel empowered to be able to sit down and write about the things that happened to me and get them out.
Do you think that, is there a part of that that, because you have so much work experience, and your work experience is always collaborating with other people.
Right.
And so do you think that you've had enough experiences that aren't so good collaborating with people, that it sort of is a relief to just not have to even put that effort in and to be able to do it yourself?
You know, that's a really good question. You know, you know, when you work in Hollywood and you work at the studios, it's, I mean, in, like in any industry, you know, it has its own personality, and there are certain kinds of people you come across and you deal with. And yet, and you're always around people, and it's a lot of talking and a lot of, you know, creativity and thinking things through. And when you're writing, it's a very solitary, sedentary activity.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a piece of me that sometimes misses being around all of that collaboration and the creativity that comes from the collaboration.
Mm-hmm.
But then I think to a lot of the, you know, there were also a lot of negative experiences with that.
And, like, give me an example.
You know, you have to work with people sometimes who are horrible to work with, or who are, you know, divas, or who are, you know, soul crushing people.
Or just have bad ideas.
And a lot of people in the entertainment industry, well, bad ideas are a dime a dozen.
Right, right, right.
But, you know, in the entertainment business, I think it's again, every business has people who fail upward. But I think in the entertainment business, mm-hmm. it's easier to do that and go undetected. It's easier to be mediocre and have people not really notice. It's like, as I say in my book, it's like the emperor's new clothes, but bought at a consignment shop.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's like there are a lot of people who are in these jobs, and they're there because of their cousins, or they're there because, you know, they've been at the studio for so long that nobody moves them out, or they've, whatever it is. And they're not necessarily the best or the smartest or the most creative, but they're lucky.
Right.
And this business sort of is good about turning a cheek to that.
Yeah.
And it's very frustrating.
It can be frustrating. So what is a positive experience, or can you recall a positive experience that you had collaborating with someone, like having a really great time and feeling like it just came out better, the project was better because the two of you did it together, or the three of you, or the groups, or whatever it was?
Yeah, I mean, there was one, one particular project that comes to mind was a movie, believe it or not, you know, having worked at major studios, and then I, you know, worked at Lifetime, and I was, as we said, head of PR there. And I worked on a small movie with Sigourney Weaver called Prayers for Bobby.
Mm-hmm.
And it was interesting because it was a movie that was made for not a lot of money, but it had a really good message. And there was some strife between the various producers, and it wasn't the most pleasant experience behind the cameras. But it was a great movie that we all believed in. And Sigourney and I sort of were a united front, and we went out there together. And, you know, she said, I'll do whatever I need to do. And I said, and I'll push however I need to push. And we basically went out there and got that movie in front of people. And she had a Golden Globe nomination at the end of it. She had an Emmy nomination at the end of it. And we got a lot of attention for that movie. And it became, the message of the movie became so important to us that the rest of it and what had gone on to bring that movie to people didn't even matter.
Right.
You know, the movie turned out well, and we went out there and we got it in front of people, and it got it enough in front of people to get recognized. And so that was an experience where you had somebody who did her job and was passionate about it, but then went beyond that.
Right.
And, you know, gave it everything she had.
Which is awesome.
Yeah.
So you feel like you had an ally in it too.
Yes.
Like you had a partnership.
Yes. And that happens a lot. I mean, you mentioned I work with Nancy Grace a lot. Mm-hmm. She's also somebody who's very passionate and really good about putting her money where her mouth is. And, you know, we work really well together and collaborate well.
Mm-hmm.
So
where you can bounce ideas off each other. I mean, you know, it's like even just directing, I'm all about collaborating. Mm-hmm. I just my ego, for whatever reason, doesn't feel like I have to know the end all be all. I'm always open, but I do know what I want, but I'm always willing to listen. But, you know, the last piece of the collaboration is like going in the editing room, and there's nothing, you know, worse than like just cutting that time down to like having no time with the editor, because that's the last person that I have the luxury of like collaborating with. And then the job's over and then it airs and that's the end of that.
And next.
I know. So right. It's like the last collaboration is that with the editor, and it always is like, oh, that collaboration's over. There's always a little sadness at the end of an episode, even when they're really bad or I have a terrible experience. Because there are some jobs that I have, literally, I will get up in the morning and I always try to just like think about being of service, doing the best I can. And sometimes I will get up and I will be like, I just wish I was going to McDonald's to work today. Like, that's like devastating to me, my spirit, when I feel that way. But still,
I bet you make a great egg McMuffin.
But even that, I love those. Those are so good. I do. I love those.
And now there's the light one with the egg whites.
Is that right?
Yes.
I'm on a cleanse. So can we not talk about food?
It's actually good for you.
It's okay. I shouldn't be doing anything.
What cleanse are you on?
I don't know. You know what? It's just like I went to the DGA Awards Saturday night. And everyone was so thin, and they're not even all actors. The actors are super thin.
You mean now the directors are thin, too?
Now the directors, everyone's
where
really...
Where will it stop?
So it's just like, there is
next,
no
next, it'll be
way.
The producers, and then the craft services people will get skinny.
Oh, my God. It's out of control.
So wait, what is this
out
cleanse?
Of control.
Please tell me it's not one of these juice things where you're running to the bathroom every 5 minutes.
No. Okay. It's this Dr. Hyman, like lowering your blood sugar. It's a 10-day thing to just get off of, like... It just resets your clock, kind of. All so, right. No, I'm eating food. I can't do those juice things.
Honestly, what is that?
I can't do that. I couldn't even show up tonight.
Sei gesund. Everyone who's doing that, go with God. Good for you.
I can't do that.
Doesn't work for me.
I can't do that. So that was your best collaboration. Give me an example of what your worst collaboration was.
I mean, I wouldn't say that. I don't like to say it's the best. It was a good one.
Yeah.
A not so good collaboration. I don't know. I mean, the thing is...
Anytime you just wanted to like for me, it's like, I just want to quit.
Oh, all the time at a movie studio. I mean,
oh, really?
It depends on what hour you'd call me.
So tell me what
but
it's like.
But you work with a lot of people. Like, I worked with a lot of like horrible women.
Okay, that's fair enough.
And that's not anything sexist. That's just the people I happened to work for were women.
And this is in marketing publicity departments.
Yeah.
So what happened?
A lot of bitchy
movie,
women so- who I worked with who weren't really great at what they did.
Okay, but they've been doing
no
it for
vision,
a long time.
Had no vision, no understanding of, you know, the contemporary marketplace or how things had evolved from when they started. You know, the fact that things aren't done the same way that they may have been. You know, it's evolved. You know, everything has evolved with media and how things get done.
All right,
you know,
so back up for a second. So walk us through when a movie's done.
Right.
Say it's a movie for television because you're still executive producing movies for television for Lifetime and Hallmark.
Right.
So... Step us through, like, once the movie's done and it's being cut, at what point does the publicity marketing start? And how do you decide what that campaign is going to be about?
Well, for a feature, publicity and marketing start, you know, really concurrently with development, because you start to come up with, you know, how you're going to position this for the public and, you know, that you're staffed appropriately to do that. And then when the movie's in production, there's a lot of PR work that has to be done. You know, still photography has to be done. Production notes have to be written. Electronic press kits and interviews with all of the cast have to be gathered. Key art. So
you're creating all of that
photography
while it's happening.
For posters and all marketing materials.
Right.
That's happening in real time.
Right.
So, you know, there's no, it's sort of a long process, just as long as a production process. Really.
So does the vision for the movie come together as you hear behind the scenes, as you hear people talking about it and you look at footage of it, does it change? Has there been a time when you thought you knew what a movie was about and then all of a sudden it changed once it was actually finished?
Yeah, I mean, you read, I mean, I used to read the scripts before they'd even go into production to have an idea of what these movies were and what was coming down the pike and how it fit into the rest of our slate of movies and how we would position it. And, you know, if I knew something was coming up a certain way, like how I might leverage that against a movie that I knew wasn't going to be as popular and I needed to save my favor to call in or like there are things you sort of assess along the way, even when it's in the script stage.
Right, right.
And yeah, there are plenty of movies where I've read the scripts and I'm like, oh, that sounds interesting. And then I've seen the movie and I'm like, that should have stayed on the page.
And, you know, and how about the opposite where you read a script and you're like, oh, that's terrible. And then the movie was good.
Happens
that
all the time. I'm sure you've seen that too. Or have you ever seen something where you know when you're on a set, when you're watching the scenes, you're like, this isn't going to be good.
Well,
this
is not going to end well. I had, I think it was my third, maybe fourth episode of television. And I got a script that, no, I knew was not good. Like it was just not good. And so I did everything I could. I mean, at that point I needed a job. I'm trying to establish myself as a director.
Right.
And like, I've got like a piece of shit.
Right.
That I've got to do something with.
Right.
And so, you know, I worked really hard and got all the departments and, you know, came up with something to make it.
But see, I think that's something in your role that you can do. You can elevate, you know, as they say, turn chicken shit into chicken salad. I think you can, you have the opportunity to elevate that. When you're a marketing person, I have no say in the material itself.
So
I get what I'm given.
And
then I have
to
sell that to the public. Well, yes, the trailer. But I've seen trailers that are better than the... I mean, obviously. I mean, I've seen trailers that should win an Oscar before the movie does.
Right. And that's part of your job then, right?
I mean...
If the movie sucks, you have to try to create...
You sell it no matter what. I mean, my job is to get people in. But I do not have a say creatively. So I don't get to say, well, you know, it would be great if you could cut this scene and add this and, you know, maybe the movie would be better.
Right.
And nor would you want that as a director. Would you want a marketing person coming in and saying, Rosemary, we don't think these shots are going to, like, we don't think this movie's going to be reviewed well based on these shots.
I'm not sure. I don't think that's information that is not useful to a director, actually.
But at what point do you let people who are not necessarily the creative types come in and dictate what the product's going to look like?
Well, you know, movies are tough, right? Because what happens with movies is, as you know, you have multiple screenings of movies before they're done.
Right.
So you actually get used to a lot of different kinds of people's input.
Right.
Who are really not, sometimes they don't even get what you're trying to do. But that's part of the process. And as directors, we have to accept that's part of the process.
I mean,
and it kills me.
But we're part of the process to some degree. Like I would be in certain meetings where they would come to me and they would say, you know, this is the movie we can have. We can make offers. These are the actresses we're considering. We can go out with, you know, we can go out with offers to so-and-so, so-and-so, and so-and-so. Who do you most like to work with? Whom have you had a bad experience with? And whose publicist would you not want to deal with? And who? So a lot of times that's where a PR marketing person might have some creative control, putting some of those elements together.
Mm-hmm.
And, so that's happened with me. I mean, there have been people where, you know, I've had to deal as a studio PR person, you have to deal with people's personal publicists. And if the personal publicists are a nightmare, and so many of them are, I would make choices based on that. I'd be like, oh, I don't want to deal with her representation, so I'm going to go with this one. And they don't sometimes realize that they lose jobs or don't get jobs because of...
They don't even know. No. So what makes a publicist someone that you don't want to deal with?
Well, a lot of times, you know, there's a lot of saying no and getting people out of things as opposed to coming up with how they can do the, you know, I used to think, well, let's figure out how we can do the most, you know, and a lot of times it's just no, no, no. Like there are these gatekeepers. Also, a lot of times they leverage one client against the other. So, you know, they'll say, well, if you know, you did this. You wrote this about so-and-so, and if you think you're going to get X, Y, and Z, you know, well, does X, Y, and Z know he's being used as a pawn?
Oh, no, of course not.
Right. Now, if I knew I was being represented that way, I mean, I, again, am very I would be very much on top of my business, right. You know, and also this, a lot of times they're very good at treating their clients a certain way. And then the clients assume that that's how they're speaking to studio executives and press. And a lot of times they're not so nice to studio executives and press. And then it's really reflects poorly on the client. And a lot of times they don't even know.
Well, how would you know that?
Well,
I mean, serious, how would you know that unless somebody told you, hey, this person... I mean,
I've had that happen before. I actually have had that happen where a studio representative did mention to an actor, and the actor found out that a lot of it was true and got rid of his representation.
Well, I mean, I remember, I have asked producers before, you know, like, hey, do you like my agent when you talk to them on the mm-hmm. phone? And I've had them tell me no.
You know what? And it's good to take that temperature.
Yeah.
Because you want people who represent you should do business the way you would do business. Ugh. Otherwise, they're not really representing you, are they? They're not. Like
no.
If somebody is a representation of you, you know, it's like when you walk into a doctor's office, how you feel about that entire experience is the receptionist. So
that's true.
If the receptionist is a bitch...
That's
the doctor
true.
Could walk on water and you already have a bad taste in your mouth.
No, that's true. Even from the person, you're right. Just even when it's on the phone, you're making the appointment.
You know,
if it's somebody on the
phone. That person represents the doctor.
It's true.
And if the call is combative or nasty or unpleasant, then your feeling about the person that receptionist is representing is not good.
But sometimes do you think that, like, sometimes I have this idea that, like, well, this person that represents me, I want them to be like a shark. Because I'm maybe not that, but they can then as a team, again, and going back to collaborating.
Yes, but
teamwork,
that depends on what their role is. Like if you're talking about an agent, mm-hmm. yes, you want a shark.
So not somebody that's like me.
But I think a lot of the publicists can be kind of bitchy. I mean, they can be kind of bitchy and you want to say like, come on.
Not necessary.
You know, it's like a power thing, a gatekeeper thing.
I think we have a caller.
Uh-oh.
Caller, you're on the air. Hello.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi, it's Kevin.
Hi, Kevin.
Hi, Kevin.
How are you?
Good. I'm so glad that you had the guts. It's very impressive.
Well, I needed to.
So what can I answer for you?
Do you have a good question for us? I'm really happy too. I'm really happy that you called in. I like people that do what they say they're going to do.
I think
that's really important
Kevin's
in life.
Kevin's an outstanding guy.
I really like that. So do you have a good question?
I've also been saying that we're going to get married, so you just keep waiting.
Okay, well, I'll wait for that Cartier platinum ring with diamonds.
Okay.
My ring size is a 9.
Okay. Mm-hmm. I made a note of that.
All right. So what can we answer for you?
Where are you from?
I'm from West Virginia.
Oh, nice. What's it like there right now? It's cold?
Very cold and snowing.
Oh, wow.
Not to rub it in, but it's 84 degrees here.
Yeah, it's crazy. It's beautiful.
That was exactly to rub it in.
You know me too well already.
Well, I have the advantage of reading your book.
There you go. So is there anything, what surprised you most in my book?
I guess what surprised me most was actually how much in common our childhoods were.
Really?
Yeah. And other gay people I've talked to and know and whatever.
So how old were you when you came out?
19.
And how were they about that?
My dad was fine.
Mm-hmm.
Had a little bit of trouble with my mom, but...
But she came around.
You know, everything's good now.
Right. It's funny.
It didn't last long.
But it is kind of interesting, like, as times change, you know, how people's attitudes change. And there are certain things, like, which I talk about in the book, my father's sister is gay. And my grandparents, her parents, had a very hard time with that. Mm. And, you know, I look back at it and you want to indict them for it. But the truth is, their attitudes were commensurate with the times. And, you know, so it's hard to sort of go back and, you know, you can't rewrite history, And I think that they would have different attitudes today.
Well, and sometimes it goes back to the community that you live in and how right. open is that community, whether you're in a place that's urban or very remote, and how open people are around you. And sometimes I think people get worried.
Right.
And they get scared.
Right.
You know, and they want to get protective, but it comes out in judgment.
Yeah.
When I came out, I just decided everybody was going to have to deal with it, whether they liked it or not. If there was a problem, it was their problem, not mine.
Good for you.
Was there something specific that, like, sort of gave you that that sort of sense of control over it? Because I feel like it took me, literally, it wasn't until I was 31 till I felt that way.
I was always reading.
Mm-hmm.
And so I knew about the world outside of this little town. Of course, you know, this is so far before the internet and everything, and you only had like 4 TV channels.
Wow.
But I read. I read everything I could get my hands on. So I knew there was more out there and people who couldn't have cared less that I was gay. And I don't know. I just always had the attitude that this is me. I mean, if you don't like it, too bad.
I think that's great.
Yeah, me too. And you live still in where you grew up, in the same place, right?
I moved away for a while, but I came back home.
That's nice.
It's a family farm. I mean, there's
a farm.
6 houses here, and
so did they need you?
My grandparents were here.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so it was like we have a extended family that call it the compound. It's nothing like a compound, but
I think I prefer to call it a farm. Compound sounds a little culty to me.
Yeah.
Sounds a little scary, and you don't sound scary. You sound really nice.
Yeah. No, he's Thank not you. Scary at all.
No,
he's not. All right,
nice.
Well, Kevin, I will talk again.
Really, really, really happy that you called, and again, you did what you said you were going to do.
Yeah, you're a stand-up guy.
Stand-up guy. I love
Thank
that.
You.
Thank you so much,
Thank
Kevin.
Thank you very much.
Take care.
You too.
All right, so I just want to say about collaboration, just to end on this note, which is like, I want to take...
You're going to drive that collaboration shit home.
Because I'm going to put this out there to the world. I want to make a series. I want to collaborate with you. I want to make a TV series out of this book.
And
this is
should.
My goal. This is my goal, people. Okay? So that's how I'm going to say that. So tell everybody, you know, do you have any closing thoughts or anything you want to say? Or,
wait, is it over?
We have like 3 minutes left, so I want to make sure you get in whatever you want to get in and your Twitter stuff.
That is the
and
most
all
fun I've had with my clothes on.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh,
that means maybe
you'll come back sometime.
Yes. I don't know. I don't know. I love what you're doing. I love this whole conversation and the idea that, you know, you're looking at entertainment from a whole different perspective and mm-hmm. how sort of every yes. part of the industry comes together and works together to put out what people see and they think is such a simple thing and how much thought and collaboration, the word of the day.
No, it's true.
I feel like if we were on Sesame Street, collaboration would come
would
up on the bottom of your screen right now.
That really was the impetus for starting this podcast.
You know, and it gives people a real understanding of how this business works and how mm-hmm. a piece of entertainment doesn't just happen.
Right.
You know, that so much right. thought and energy and creativity and care goes into some of what we all take for granted.
Yeah, I mean, I could have talked the whole hour just about marketing like one movie and everything that went into it.
Oh, so could I.
Because I don't know. That fascinates me. But I mean, that fascinates me because
yeah.
I don't know how they end up with the trailers. Or why are trailers an art form that hasn't changed in a million years?
Well, because we know that, you know, what it takes, you know what audience you're going after for a certain movie. You know, they split movies into quadrants. So they'll say it's a 4-quadrant movie, which mm-hmm. means that we're kind of broad. We're going after everybody. Or it's a single quadrant movie, which might be, you know, we're going after just women or we're going after just
right.
men or we're
right.
going after. So, you know, they cut a trailer to appeal to the broadest audience for that particular movie.
Yeah, well, I'm over the trailer. So tell everybody where they can find you.
I'm on Twitter at Josh Sabara, Sabarra. And I'm on Facebook. It's Josh Sabara Author. And I'm on Instagram at Josh Sabara. And my book's on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, in Barnes & Noble, wherever
Porn
books
Again.
Are sold. Porn Again, a memoir.
Best-selling book on
yes.
Amazon.
Yes.
That's awesome. I can't wait for the next book, by the way.
Well,
so you got to get it done.
You will get a galley copy the minute it's done.
I want this to still be on the best-selling book at Amazon, like the best-selling list on Amazon, when your book comes out.
Well, we'll then have to do a push. You'll have to have the TV series ready to go by then.
Oh, my God. So come on, all you producers out there. Let's get moving. Okay, great. Thank you for joining us again. It's Rosemary Rodriguez. You can find me at Rosemary Drex on Twitter. Facebook is Rosemary Rodriguez, Instagram at Rosemary Directs. I have a movie coming out. Oh, gosh, I can't wait to go to Sedona Film Festival weekend after next. I'll tell you about it next week. But Silver Sky is the movie. And thank you so much. And I look forward to having you back again, Josh.
Anytime.
Thank you.
Come on, people. It's time to live it up.